Might seem impossible that our insects can thrive in the weather extremes that we have here in the state, and especially when you think of how delicate butterflies seem. It's always a wonder when they show up like clockwork in the spring. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. Great to have him back. And we always talk with him about things going on in the world of insects. He's an entomologist, of course, and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, and I'm definitely enjoying the emeritus status part of it. But the spring has started out, and I was out last week in the woods, and lo and behold, on one of those very nice days, saw my first spring butterfly. So that's always a treat. It was a morning cloak, which seems to be the most common. There's a group of brush-footed butterflies that will overwinter as adults, and so you get these nice sunny days, and they're up and about. And I think I saw an angle wing. I just couldn't get close enough as it was whizzing by, and they'll lay low for the next 3 or 4 days when it's cold, but if we get a nice sunny day and get above 55 degrees, you might be blessed with seeing one.
So those two, any other type, any other?
Well, that family in particular, as I said, we do have some migrants that you never know. You know, if you get the right airflow, you get up here, but that's pretty much it. So many of the other ones are in the chrysalis form, and it's going to take some heat to get them to develop enough to start emerging. So some of the swallowtails and some of those. One of the other first ones is that little white imported cabbage worm that we see. Again, that's in a chrysalis form, but boy, they seem to come out very quick. And they like to lay their eggs on various mustards. And of course, that's one of the first weeds that come up. So it won't be long now, especially if we get some sustained 4 or 5 days of very warm temperatures.
And the moths are similar to butterflies as to when they emerge.
Kind of all over the board. We do have some moths that spend the winter as adults. In fact, people that are out collecting syrup for maple syrup often complain because if you get a nice warm day, some of those moths are attracted to the sugar water and dive in and contaminate things. And so, but for the most part, a lot of those things, we have a lot of migrating moths that come up here, a much bigger group. You know, we have 150 species of butterflies approximately you could expect to find. Moth-wise, we're probably closer to 3,000 to 4,000 species of moths in the state.
And how do they overwinter? Where do they just get under leaf?
Yeah, usually tissue? Find some protected area, and being cold-blooded, they can pretty much quiet down and stay low. And for that reason, why people think you do a favor when you bring insects in the winter, it really doesn't, because they usually are not in a physiological state that they can feed, and they burn their energy reserves because it's warmer. So like even the woolly bears, our little friend, the woolly bears, their game is that they don't even spin their cocoons down until this time of the year. They spend the winter as full-grown caterpillars under rocks and, in firewood piles and those kind of things.
And this weather, is it really going to have an impact? Is it, here we are getting snow.
Yeah. The only time I expect to see weather impact. So the cold, there's a couple things that probably didn't do well, but overall I didn't see the cold doing much. And when I'm questioned about ticks and mosquitoes, I don't see this affecting it. What you might expect to see is if we do get a warm up and the trees break bud and everything starts to grow and the tent caterpillars start to come out and then you get this weather, that's when I see a weather impact. But you basically got to wake them up and get them active first and then slam the door rather than, as I said, in most cases, things are still pretty much dormant in waiting for both the heat, and then, of course, if you're eating plants, the plants have got to start growing. It's no good to come out when plants aren't growing. So when plants start to break bud is often the time the insects are waking up.
And so in terms of predicting what kind of a season we're going to have for butterflies is...
Yeah, way too early. I 2012 was not a good year for butterflies. The stress of the drought, and for that reason, 2013 really was a very quiet butterfly year as far as I was concerned. And, one of the more disappointing ones. Even the monarchs were so late to get here. But it's really too early to tell for the other things. One would hope we'd see some rebounding with some of these populations.
I would hope so. Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, our guest today. We have open lines for you at 1-800-642-1234 with your insect questions or comments. Becky in Milwaukee has a comment. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Last fall, my winter creep had a terrible amount of scale insects. I looked that up, and I think that's what it was. And I'm digging it out. Portions of it is totally dead. The other portions are, very, very damaged. Can I just grow something else in there, or does that soil contaminate it as well?
Yeah, no problem with that. I'm guessing it's Euonymus scale. When you're dealing with scale, it's good to look. But what it kind of works in is The scales we get indoors on our tropical plants are a problem because they're generalists. They get on all kinds of plants. The scales we deal with outside in Wisconsin are usually very plant specific. And so the only way you get into trouble is if you put the same plant in the area. They're always a challenge to control because they have life stages that are not available. So it takes persistence, whatever you choose. And you got to know what scale you've got to find out what the proper timings are. So they are one of the more difficult groups of insects to chemically treat. But yeah, if you're removing and putting other kinds of plant material, there should be no concern at all, other than if you put other plants in the species Euonymus. A burning bush would not be a good choice, although I don't see them very happy on burning bush. It's basically winter creeper is the plant that gets hit the hardest.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So I'm going to do vegetables. I'll be okay?
Definitely be okay.
Yeah. Thanks, okay. Becky. Appreciate the call. I had a question about ticks, and I'm sure it's my question, but I'm sure a lot of other people have it too. We were out last weekend out in the outdoors, and going to be out all day, and I used a permethrin product on my clothing that supposedly will last a couple of weeks and be effective and kill ticks. You apply it out of a can and let it sit a couple hours until it dries, and then you can pretty much use it. What about the effectiveness or safety of that?
Well, you know, that is the product I suggest when I'm talking to people about personal protection, because although it's sold as a repellent, it's an acaricide. It will kill them. And the problem with DEET and the like is, although in some of the natural products, repellents mean, you know, they're just going away from it. But if you have a part of your person that's not treated, they're fine. With this product, if they walk in your treated clothing, the tick will die. And that's very important to prevent any kind of transmission. We use much more concentrated forms of this on head shampoos for head lice or for creams for scabies mites. Mm. So following the directions, I think the biggest problem I see is people are trying to cut corners at times. And, you know, you can buy the clothing spray. This is what it's made for. But they can find the same active ingredient in vegetable sprays and termite sprays. And so people start, you know, kind of doing home remedies here. And the problem with that is then we get into some health concerns, yeah. Both because concentrations, carriers. When I hear somebody's putting termite treatment on their clothes, I mean, I just shudder. And it's illegal. I mean, it's, you know, yeah. It's like drugs. You have to follow the directions. So, yes. And you know, the thing that we preach in this state in particular with deer tick activity is anytime there's no snow on the ground. Yeah, I've had people 3 weeks ago that were out with their dogs and whatnot. And sure enough, they were already picking up ticks, and I was not surprised because as soon as the snow goes and you get a little bit of warmth, the ticks are active. So the same thing, you know, today with a little snow on the ground, probably not a problem. But by late this afternoon on the south slope of a hill, they'll wake up and be active.
And the other thing about the permethrin is they say before you apply it again, you should wash the clothing. And is there a reason for that? Is it a concentration issue?
Yeah, I think what they're trying to do is have a better handle on exposure. But yeah. Again, once you put on the clothing, and the label says you spray the clothes and not have them on your person, it often dries very quickly. There are other forms of this where you can buy concentrated forms, soak your clothes in it for a couple hours, and then let them line dry for a couple days. I think that's very much overkill yeah. in most cases. I think the other thing that there are impregnated permethrin clothing you'd buy at sporting goods stores. So somebody spends an awful lot of time. The thing about those particular clothing is that you can wash them numerous times and it's still active.
Wow.
And so, as I said, there's kind of a number of different ways of approaching this. But the bottom line, I think, you know, if you've got a pair of work Carhartts or whatnot, you know, you spray them, and as you said, you can use them for a week or two. You don't have to reapply it on a daily basis as you would any kind of repellent. And as I said, even though the repellents are quite effective, the permethrin is more effective.
Kurt in Stevens Point, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about my family's interested in possibly planting a butterfly garden, and I was hoping to get some advice on how to proceed.
Okay. Well, there's a couple points about butterfly gardening. Your success for attracting diversity will be more related to the diversity of habitat around you, because different butterflies live in different areas. Now, there's two things that people will do purposely to help butterflies is plant plants that they potentially can breed on. So for monarchs, that's things like swamp milkweed and common milkweed. For the black swallowtail, it's things like parsley and carrot and the like. But then the other side of it is to plant a diversity of flowers Native flowers seem to work better. You know, some plants are bred for the look of the flower, but not nectar sources and whatnot. Most of our native plants are insects have evolved with it, so they usually have the right things to attract them. But then the other side of it is try to keep things blooming all season long because there are butterflies. So that's kind of it. You look at native plants, you try to get enough diversity and seasonality that will draw things in and kind of go from there. So a lot of good recommendations you can find on the internet specifically to plants. But as I said, if I had to make a general comment, is there's two or three things you can plant on purpose. You can always put a cabbage plant out there, and I guarantee you, you'll get cabbage butterflies. and again, for kids, that's fun to watch. And to sacrifice these plants it really is not much of a problem, I think. But then the other side, as I said, stick with some of the native plants. Some of the native prairie plants in particular seem to be very attractive and of course, hardy in our area. So
There you go. Thank you, Kurt.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too. I have open lines to get you on pretty quickly today at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. You have some information on deer tick viruses that I know you wanted to share, too.
Yeah, so you know, the interesting thing to watch now is the continued growing list of organisms that deer ticks are capable of transmitting. And my colleague Susan Paskowitz has got a project working with a particular virus that now is called deer tick virus. And although the instances in the state are relatively low as far as people, the best way to compare it, it's a little bit like West Nile. A lot of people probably get exposed but don't show any kind of illness to it. But certain individuals do, and then it really can be very serious. And Susan and her work is finding the infectivity rate is running about 1.3% right now in parts of the state. So it's still relatively low, but it's not something you can ignore. So aside from looking at the normal fevers and, you know, Lyme disease or anaplasmosis and type, you know, if somebody's had a tick bite and starts to develop, you know, headaches and other, the main complication is encephalitis. This. And so if you start to getting anything like that, it's good to talk to your physician and mention the tick exposure and go from there. So at least that this is on the page for a, you know, possible diagnosis. And so we're not sure where this is going to go. We know that it's, again, it's a rodent virus picked up by the ticks. But if it's going to be increasing, you know, the first cases only go back about 10, 15 years. I mean, it's not an overly long exposure in the United States in particular with it, and it's in the exact same areas that we have the deer tick. So it's up in the Northeast, and it's in the upper Midwest where we are here.
And encephalitis, typically a symptom of that would be?
Well, headaches in particular, and you know, and again, I can get really very serious very quickly.
Michelle in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. So I'm kind of piggybacking on a previous caller. I naturalized my yard about 5 years ago, or in the process, it's a big one. But so I've got the butterfly milkweed, two different kinds. Got I do parsley and dill, so I get a lot of butterflies, the swallowtails and the monarchs, and they lay eggs and they hatch, and I can see the caterpillars, but the caterpillars don't thrive. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's getting them, if it's wasps or so. I feel like my yard's out of balance still. I'm wondering if you have any advice.
No, it probably argues it's in balance. It's normal for insect populations to experience 90, 95, 98% mortality, whether it is diseases or predators or parasites and the like. And so, you know, for people who are raising monarchs, I often suggest that if you're really interested in getting higher numbers of butterflies, is when those first little eggs hatch, is bring them in the house.
Used to do that, and then they would escape, and I had cocoons under my coffee tables, and it seemed like a lot of work, but that's okay.
Yeah, so, you know, because there you're basically taking those you know, especially some of the predators and some of the parasitic wasps out of the equation. So as I said, it really is normal, and insects typically have this potential, if everything goes right, to have lots of offspring, but usually in balance that doesn't happen. So as I said, that really isn't that unusual. And there's so many things. I mean, that's one of the interesting things to do life studies on insects, to see what's involved. And sometimes it's earwigs eating little caterpillars, and sometimes it's ground beetles. And as I said, there's just a whole diversity of things. And the more diverse your environment, again, the more predators and parasites you would expect to have around.
And, you know, sometimes my milkweed is covered in little orangish kind of bugs.
Mm-hmm. That's an
what
aphid.
Are those?
Well, no, there's two things. There's a very small yellowish aphid called the milkweed aphid, and then there is a milkweed seed bug, which is kind of looks like a box elder bug, and when it gets bigger, it's got, in an adult stage, it's got some black in it. But those are quite common, often clustered just like box elder bugs, and what they do is feed on the seed of milkweed.
Yep, there you go. Thanks.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Appreciate it. UW entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri about spring insect activity and certainly inviting you to join in. Open lines at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have some great insect photos, we'd certainly love to see those as well on my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. So hope you'll do that. Stephen LaCrosse, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a small kind of butterfly garden at the back of the house here, help out the monarchs and stuff. And last summer, we got an inundation of flies, and I mean hundreds upon hundreds, if not in the thousand range. And the butterfly garden has a kind of a cocoa mulch on the ground, and they were over everything, the milkweed, the butterfly bush, everything. I even put out some of those little fly strips, and they were completely covered within a couple of days, and still hundreds upon hundreds of flies. And I checked around. I didn't see any dead animal carcasses anywhere nearby. I'm wondering if there's anything that I can do to prevent that from happening this year, and if it does, anything that I can do to cut down on the numbers of the flies.
Okay, well, where I feel somewhat handcuffed is there's so many stories that would explain this, and without knowing exactly what fly it is, and it may have nothing to do with the butterfly garden in particular. Okay. Usually when we get these kind of emergences, it turns out to be something like there's a group of flies or family called March flies, Bibionids. They breed in decaying organic matter, and you get these just blossoming of adults everywhere. And so, as I said, without seeing a good picture of the fly, and flies are really not very easy to identify for people because they're you know, entomologists are usually looking at the wings and counting the number of hairs on the thorax. I mean, so many flies look alike and are very different. And that's my big question is if I knew what kind of fly is, we'd know what the source is, and then we could see if we've got some control of it or not. But my first take on it has got nothing to do with the butterfly garden. It was just a natural phenomenon. They were just hanging out all over. And I said, the March flies are one group, but I can think of other flies. It's true that, you know, dead animals produce both blowflies and flesh flies, but there's a bunch of other parasitic flies that look similar to that. And as I said, my other take on it is if it is one of these weird natural phenomena, you might never see it again, would be my take. There are some skippers, which is another group of flies. They get the name because the maggots jump, that I have seen associated with cocoa beans. But I see the maggots in the cocoa bean mulch, but I don't see many adult flies. So that's why I wasn't taking you that direction as far as what the possibility was. But yeah, if it pops up again, if you can get a good picture or catch a couple, put in alcohol and send it down to the university, and we'll take a look.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Chris in Port Wing. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you doing today? Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Great. I've got these bugs. I haven't seen one yet, but they're burrowing into insulation. I've got 2-inch rigid foam insulation on this roof of an outbuilding that's covered with metal.
Mm-hmm.
And they burrow into it, and I can tell because I get little piles, little yellow piles of the insulation eaten up and spewed out in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And then now the woodpeckers are going after them, evidently, because there's some big holes up in the area close to where the insulation is in the siding, in the pine siding of the building. What do you think is drilling in there, and how do you take care of them?
Well, it's two possibilities. You know, carpenter ants will nest in foam insulation. And typically when you get that residue that we call frass that they're kicking out, it won't just be insulation. There'll be little insect fragments mixed with it. But the other possibility that I've seen quite common is in that kind of situation where you might have flies or lady beetles getting up underneath the little voids between the roof space and the insulation. A lot of those die. And then there's an animal we call a larder beetle. It's technically a type of carpet beetle. It feeds on those dead carcasses. But then when it wants to move from point A to point B, it'll drill through the insulation very easily. And typically there, you sometimes see cast skins of these. They're little dark brown, somewhat hairy worms with a pair of little spines on the tail end. And that's how you could identify them. So I think it's going to take a little bit more detective work. If you go up there to repair where the woodpeckers are attacking, you may again get to get some evidence that's worth sending down and letting us take a look at. But that would be my two takes, either carpenter ants or larder beetles feeding on the carcasses of dead insects that are up in there. But they'll feed on dead mice. I mean, anything dead. So, you know, I had one case where a bird had died up by a brand new skylight. Now, carpenter ants don't attack sound wood, so I could rule that one out. But the sawdust was coming out of the skylight, and we thought, well, did we have some kind of weird wood borers in there and the like? But no, it turned out to be larder beetles that had fed on that carcass. And as I said, when they ran out of food, they started migrating. And that's when they would drill through this, you know, inch and a half oak trim that was up there. And so, you know, in either case, it's kind of a source reduction. You know, in the case of the larder beetles, there may be some tightening you can do so that the insects don't get into that space. So if there's no insects, there's nothing for them to eat. If it's carpenter ants, if you can find where the nest site is and just spot treat it, it should clean up pretty quickly. So,
what do you spot treat it with?
Honestly, any indoor, outdoor, you know, insecticide, you know, the bug be gones and the like. For insulation like that, to be honest, I like powdered or dust more than sprays, because sometimes some of the sprays have carriers that will melt through the insulation, which is not good. So I usually like to blow dusts into those areas and suffice. So yeah, just about anything you find in the lawn and garden store that is registered for putting on houses or in houses would be sufficient.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Kathleen and Delavan, your turn. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Well, I was very excited about finding a product that you could use for raising monarchs outside. And I don't work for this company, but it's a 4x4 or a 4x6, like a little screened enclosure with a door to get in. Mm-hmm. And you can put it right over your milkweed plants.
Yeah, that is really, again, if you don't want to go through the hassle, the one caller earlier had said that little critters are crawling around the house, that's not so good. So coming up with some kind of physical protected barrier, and usually then I would assume the screening is going to allow enough light that the plants are going to thrive, but going to be small enough that the parasites can't get after them. And we've done the same thing, for people that grow dahlias sometimes have a very difficult time, especially if you're in a rural area, with corn rootworm beetles coming in and eating all the flowers. And because these things are migrating in by the millions, you know, it's not something physically you're going to spray, and you don't want to spray blooming plants anyway. So it's the same kind of story, is that coming up with these physical screen houses or whatnot, even though, unfortunately, aesthetically, it's not as nice. But if you're real serious about growing dahlias without getting the blossoms eaten off in those situations, that really, to me, is the only thing that makes sense.
Well, can I give the name of this company in case people want to get these?
Certainly. Sure.
It's Gardner Supply Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they're either $40 or $60, depending on the size.
Oh,
and they're reusable. And they're nice looking.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So, okay,
thank you. Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. Gardner Supply. There we go. We have lots of emails up, and there was one that I wanted. I'm just looking for it right now. Oh, Chuck, and wanted to point out, we were talking about permethrin earlier as a spray on clothing to protect against ticks. And Chuck wanted to point out that pyrethrins and pyrethroids can be toxic to cats. And so it's...
Sure. Well, you know, a point that I always make when I'm talking about using things. So how would you find that out? It's on the label,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you can make generalities. Now, regular pyrethrum is a natural insecticide from chrysanthemums. The pyrethroids are synthetic versions. Very toxic on fish, relatively non-toxic to most animals, but they are toxic to cats. And you explain to people that insecticides have personalities. You know, you can have some general comments. It's relatively non-toxic to most animals, but there can be exceptions. And as I said, that's why we preach. And unfortunately, the studies tell us that the biggest abusers of pesticides are homeowners, because they don't read. And I mean, we're talking 60, 70% of the time people are using chemicals, they're not reading the labels. And how can they have any idea to properly use it or to have these kind of subtleties of what kind of animals might be sensitive?
Yeah, absolutely. We had Larry in Muscadet who wanted to know how to control centipedes in the house. His mom, who lives in Wausau, has centipedes in her house and wants to get rid of them. Is there an over-the-counter something or other that she could use? Is there a likely path to follow to block them from getting in?
You know, distinguishing between centipedes and the kind of centipede, or are they millipedes? What's interesting, there are outside centipedes in Wisconsin. Occasionally they migrate in, but don't seem to cause much problem. When I get centipedes sent to the lab, typically they're something that we call the house centipede. The genus is Scutigera, which is a tropical species. You do not find it natively outdoors. Never find big numbers in the house. Probably, I think people would classify it as one of the creepiest animals that's out there because they scurry when you have the lights on. And I don't know if anybody likes centipedes. That's, and I guess I understand that. So usually low numbers. But where the frustration comes, you put an ant spray down and the like, it will help reduce numbers. But you find that the centipedes are living in the walls and attic spaces where people normally would not spray. And so totally eliminating them, I don't think it's possible. Now, another thing, if you want to get away from using the chemicals, is here's a case where they call them glue boards. There are bigger versions that they sell for catching mice and rats. You can use those or use the small versions for catching insects. You put it underneath the stove. You put it underneath, you know, places they're out of the way. And you don't want your pets or kids to get in them because the things are quite sticky. But if a centipede runs on it, it will be captured and die. And so this is a way of physically reducing the numbers. The amount of clutter in the house is somewhat affected, both because there's more places. Centipedes do like some moisture, so they tend to be more fond of the basement. But that doesn't mean they won't migrate up into the living space to eat. And then, you know, most of the time they're doing this at night and then run back down. So reducing that will help. But again, in old houses, I think the argument is that, yes, there could always be a couple hiding out in the wall voids.
Yeah.
You can't get to those. But you should not be overrun. I mean, if somebody sees one a week, that's some pretty impressive numbers, I would think. Because and the other part of it, centipedes eat insects. So the argument is, what are they eating? You know, and there's that much food there. Can we remove that to adjust the environment? So, and the good news is that, you know, although technically you handled one, they could bite you. I have never been bit by one, part of it because they're so hard to catch. And it's not their behavior to come out and bite you on purpose. It's only when they're cornered. So as I said, I really don't worry about that aspect of their biology.
Will in West Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Will.
Hello. Speaking of scurry and when the lights are turned on, I'm talking about cockroaches.
Okay.
And years ago when I helped my dad, he managed an apartment building, and we used to have to spray cockroaches, and we have to put a lot of spray on several times. Well, it developed some cockroaches in the apartment that I'm living in here. It appears to be coming from a neighbor, but the landlord is selling the place, and I don't know if he just didn't want to invest much or if this stuff is effective, but he gave us this stuff in a syringe that you just put spots on the wall. It's like a thick Vaseline.
Mm-hmm.
And I call the company. They claim that the bugs eat the stuff. The bugs die almost instantly, and then the roaches are carried back to the nest, and the rest of the roaches eat it, and it does work effectively. I wonder what your thoughts are about that. And by the by, while I got you on the line, I wonder if there's any news on the front for bed bugs or something like this.
Okay. So one of the biggest things that's changed in my career is it used to be you always sprayed for cockroaches. But now with the technologies, there are a number of baiting systems that are out there. And the nice thing about the baiting systems is generally the active ingredients are less toxic. We have more control over it. But they take a lot of on the knees getting the baits placed. You know, if you read the directions, they'll often say you have to put 150 bait placements in a kitchen. So you got to put little dabs in a lot of places. And so a lot of times people don't follow through with that. But it is true. These chemicals have ways of transferring in some cases, so that the cockroach that dies, if other cockroaches feed on the body, they'll get a secondary poisoning. But generally speaking, don't seem to pose much problem to the pets and the like. So it is a very neat technology. But as I said, it's getting under on your hands and knees, getting up underneath the kitchen sink and putting these dabs back by the pipe chases in back of drawers, those kind of things. And it takes some time. It's not, you know, sprays, you often see results in 1 or 2 days. Baiting, sometimes it's going to take a couple of weeks to really start seeing the results. But I find it's a better technology. I think so. Now, the problem with bed bugs you know, we know they're attracted to carbon dioxide and the like, but nobody has come up with a trap. Nobody's come up with a bait. So we're kind of forced now that still the technology that seems to be working the best are these heat treatments, where they come in and generate, you know, enough air temperature, often 135, 140 degrees in ambient air temperature to kill the bed bugs. But what's tough about that technology is it's an expensive technology. And so a lot of times people don't have the resources to do it. Or again, in multifamily units, the problem is you treat one, you better at minimum expect the adjacent units have not considered treating it, or you're just going to be chasing them around, which is kind of the argument with roaches, too. I mean, when you have them, because they do use pipe chases and other things to go from apartment to apartment, you kind of have to take the whole building approach, at least inspections, and make decisions rather than trying to put out the fire in just one unit.
Thanks, Will, for calling. Steve in Lake Geneva, hi.
Yes, hi there. Good morning. There were a number of excellent reports earlier this year on the plight of or recent steep decline of monarch butterfly populations, with recommendations that large areas along roads and highways be opened up to providing habitat protection. I was just wondering if there is any large-scale effort underway to rapidly expand habitat areas for monarchs and other butterflies in the state of Wisconsin, and if not, what would it take to do this?
Not that I know of, and I think it's a bit of a resource question, although I will tell you in discussions with a friend who works for the Department of Transportation, they're looking into some of those aspects of what they can do in roadsides and the like. Now, they're not looking at necessarily for this year. I think they're looking long-term, what kind of things they can do and does it fit into their plans. But definitely, I think it's something that they're taking into account, and just for that reason is to give us some more diverse habitat, and the more diverse habitat, the more creatures that are going to thrive. And the monarch thing is, you know, the weather pattern last year was terrible for getting monarchs up in this state. So you start with them the year before coming in low numbers out of the winter and then having a very bad breeding season, at least in the Midwest. And I think pretty much throughout the U.S. there was problems. So they go back into the winter with low numbers. And the only thing I can give you some encouragement is I have seen in the past when we have been in painted in some of these corners that if we can get something falling our way and getting the right weather patterns, they can recover quite quickly. But then again, the other part of this discussion is the use of herbicides and how that has removed a lot of the, you know, the roadside milkweed, the fence row milkweed and the like. And that's where this discussion's coming up is trying to create some habitat again for them. And so it is a complicated story, but as I said, I'm praying for good weather for a lot of reasons, and one of them is the monarchs.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Thank you for calling. We have Tom in La Crosse, who bought an old farm last year in August, and the barn, the house, and the outbuildings were all inundated with wasps. What do you do around the house to keep those numbers down?
Well, you know, wasps are looking for places to make their nest. And so anything you can do to reduce that is going to help out. You know, so sometimes caulking helps. It depends. Some wasps like to go underneath things. Other things are out in the open. A lot of times I've seen even for wasps that like to nest up in the eaves, like the Polistes wasps. Very frustrating because you've got a two-story house. You know, to get up there and try to treat the nests is a little bit of a health hazard because you're going to fall off the ladder. So I have seen they sell some very fine mesh screening that you can drape over there so the wasp can't get access to things, but yet the screening is fine enough mesh you can hardly see it. So that's a physical way of stopping them. But if you're looking at intervening, the way our wasp species work in this state is they're all spending the winter as queens. They're going to wake up in the next couple, 3 weeks, look for places to set up their nests sometime in May. And so that's really when you want to slam the door. You know, you don't wait till August where instead of one, we're dealing with 50 or in the case of the yellow jackets, 2,000, 3,000 individuals. So if you've got problem sites, there are sprays that can be applied in the outside. No reason to do it inside. Outside of the structure. And as I said, we would apply those in the late spring, early summer in the places we've been seeing the activity.
We got a Facebook question from Peggy wondering if those mason bee houses that you see commercially available, are they a good way to attract those great pollinators?
Yes, but you can make them yourself. You know, there's two ways. I mean, some cases they're selling you the mason bees already inside the mason bee houses. and there are larvae in there. And so you bring them and they warm up and then you get the adults out. And the biggest problem mason bees have is they're looking for the equivalent of a straw that's 3/8 of an inch in diameter and 3 or 4 inches deep. And so some people will just take pieces of logs and whatnot and drill them and set them up. Or you can buy the commercial houses, either or. You still need mason bees in the neighborhood. So you can provide the house. If not in the neighborhood, it's not going to show. But they really, there's at least two, I think three species of native mason bees in the state. And again, if you've got a lot of woods and other diverse habitat around you, I expect to have mason bees in the area. So, yes, whether you make them yourself or buy them, but there's nothing other than the critical size. And I'll tell you, if you make holes bigger and smaller, there are other species of wasps and bees that will utilize that habitat.
Kathy in Greenfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Phil, and thank you, Larry.
Sure.
I have a question. A friend of mine ordered a praying mantis egg. Little thing, and they hatch, and I have a problem with, I know you have a limey, Larry, but I have a Meyer lemon, and yes, I'm getting the honeydew on it, and I figure I have aphids. So she had given me a few of the praying mantises.
Yeah.
This is in my house. Is it okay to release the praying mantises in my house?
Yes, but I don't think they're going to do what you want to. It turns out that they tend to concentrate on bigger food, so they're more likely to eat each other than they are aphids or mites or scales in particular. They're looking for bigger prey. So if you had spider mites in particular, there are predaceous mites you can order on the internet from some of these biological control houses that let them go, and they would get you into a natural balance. And if it's aphids, same thing. There are little parasitic wasps that can be released, and they're very tiny. They look like little gnats, but they will lay their eggs in. So get a proper identification of what the critter is, and then, as I said, if you're looking for a natural control, there are places you can order these things. They'll ship them in the mail. Now, this gets a little problematic here at this time of the year because it's cold enough that you get nervous. Again, about things being shipped, but very quickly it's going to warm up enough that that won't be an issue. But that's something to look into. Said Gardens Live supplies some of this stuff, although they're kind of a secondary. They don't produce it. The Arizona Biological Supply Company. So there's a number of companies that do specialize in this kind of thing. And usually I find their customer service is very helpful.
Are going to die, these little bugs?
Boy, if you can't find something to feed them, potentially. When they first hatch, I know sometimes some of my colleagues have played with fruit flies, but very quickly they're looking for bigger stuff. So you almost have to go to the pet store and buy some of the insects that people feed, lizards and whatnot, to feed the mantids to keep them going. You can also probably, again, if we get a break in the weather in a week or two, let them go and they can fend for themselves. And the mantids are, it's interesting, we've talked on the show before how we know in the last 5 to 10 years we have mantids for the first time breeding in the state. We've equated that to the lack of cold winters. That is one animal I'm a little bit concerned that it was a cold enough winter that the egg cases would freeze out. So we will see. Now, I expect them to come back up if we have a little bit more reasonable winters again. But they said in the scheme of things, they probably had a tough time getting through this -20 below because that's the kind of temperature that gets them in trouble.
So hang on to them for a couple, maybe a week or so, and then release them out in the yard.
Right. Now, one of the things you could do to help them out a little bit is if you can capture them and put them in a container and keep them in the fridge. Because, again, you're metabolically slowing them down, and so their food needs are going to be less. Boy, if you get it to be 50 degrees, have at it.
Thanks, Kathy. Thank you for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Phil Pelletieri as we take a look at the world of insects. Open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we have some posts on the page. Mail Lady Mary, just south of Duluth, Minnesota, sent a couple photos. What do we got here?
So the top one, which might look kind of like a fat abdomen on an ant, turns out to be an animal we call a blister beetle. The family is a soft-winged beetle. This one happens to belong to the genus called Meloe, M-E-O-L-O-E, I think is the way it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. The name blister beetle comes through the fact that they contain a chemical that if crushed, they can cause a blistering. And although I don't see this much on people, big concern for horse owners because there are cases where blister beetles will cause enough irritation in the gut tract to kill the animals.
Oh, boy.
Different species, some are associated with grasshoppers, some are associated with bees where they're parasitic on them. This happens to be out of the bee group, parasitic, but really kind of a neat critter. And as I said, the only caution would be is don't crush it against your skin, and most people I don't think would. Now, the other one is an extremely long abdomen on a wasp, and this is from a particular family we call Pelecynids. And Pelecynids are grub parasites, and they use this very long abdomen to burrow into the ground to lay their eggs to go after grubs. And so, again, harmless to people, very interesting. I mean, we're talking a creature that's upwards of 3.5-4 inches long from tip to tail, but very long and skinny and almost all females. Males are very rare, although I have seen a couple pictures in my career. So,
Kurt in Dallas, Wisconsin, is up next with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for the great information.
Sure.
I bought a rural home 3 years ago that was pretty thick with Asian lady beetles and box elders. I went to the local ag store and bought some stuff they recommended called Tempo. Mix with water, use a sprayer, and I, you know, did the, all around the foundation, around the doors and windows, things like that, and really got rid of them. But I'm curious to know about, you know, the toxicity of that product, mm-hmm. if you know anything about it, what else is it affected on, and et cetera. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. So Tempo, the active ingredient is called cyfluthrin. It is one of the synthetic pyrethroids, which now probably account for 90% plus of what you buy at the garden store for fruits, vegetables, house spray, and the like. In this use, you know, one of the things is the way they formulate the product has an effect on how it works. And so the stuff that we use on the outside of buildings in the fall are made specifically for sticking on the walls and the like. So it's, as I said, there are other formulations of this that are used on fruits and vegetables. It's related to the permethrin we talked about, tick spray. So it's got some of the same qualities. It works quite well when it's cold. It doesn't work so well when it's really warm. In general, these products have aquatic toxicities, and so that's why we're very careful around water with them. But generally speaking, for mammals, dogs, cats, and whatnot, by nature, they're not overly toxic, although we did mention that one comment of the personality conflict between permethrin and pyrethrin in cats. You know, use according to label directions. Once you let the product dry, it's going to last for about 2 to 3 weeks. And putting it on in that September and early October time is exactly when all those fall migrating critters are coming in. And it really works quite effectively. It was used extensively in dairy barns for housefly control. So, again, it was allowed to be used there as long as you didn't get it into the food and the water. Unfortunately, because of, I would say, not proper use, we've had resistance problems. So there are a lot of cases the Tempo doesn't work against flies like it used to 15 years ago. But as in general speaking, the chemicals used now compared to the chemicals used 35 years ago when I started my career 40 years ago, for humans in particular, are less toxic.
Mm. Arlene in Burlington wants to talk with you. Let's go there. Yeah. Hi.
Hello, hello. We have two different places where we have the ground wasps. That I believe there's black, and they're in the ground near stumps. And last year, when I was weeding around the stump, they all came out and stung me all over my hands, and I ended up fainting from it. So now I have to carry one of those EpiPens around with me. But how can, now that they're dormant, what can we do? I'm not sure where the hole is. You know, some of the old time remedies was to put fuel or something down them, but how do we kill them?
Okay, so they're dead already. So now what we're starting with is typically the ground nesting yellow jackets in particular, those are the ones that give us the biggest problem, are looking for old gopher burrows, old washed out areas, old hollow places and stumps. And so they will not come back to the same site per se, but if you've got the right environment, could another queen come by and find a place? Yes. And so really plugging holes in the spring is the most important. You've got a little gopher burrow or whatnot, you plug it up so they don't have a place to start. And then once we get in the summer, what I would suggest is if you see activity You know, you have to identify the place they're coming and going. And in the spring, the numbers are so low, it's not going to get your attention. It's going to be well into August before the numbers get high enough that if you sat there on a, you know, a nice, quiet, sunny day and watched, you'd see them coming and going and say, okay, I got a problem spot there. Then what we do is we wait until the evening. I like a dust better than a spray for this case, and I just dust it into that opening, and that will take care of them. So if you got a spot treat, that's the way to do it.
Okay, so you're saying they're dead now? They're not going to come back if I...
No,
I mean,
see...
That nest is gone for the forever.
Forever. And then the new queens have to start everything from scratch, and that one queen, yellow jacket, then will be responsible for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 workers by the end of the summer. That's when the nest is threatened, that's when we have the biggest problem with them. But really, it isn't so much they freeze out, they starve out. Because unlike bees that bring in honey for their own fuel and food source in the winter, all our other bees and wasps don't work that way in this state. And so they, again, typically everything but the fertilized queens die. They hibernate or overwinter is the way term we use for them. And then wake up in the spring and start everything from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Starting in a new place. Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank
All right.
you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Arlene. Thank you for calling. We have Jake and Osceola up next. Hi, Jake.
Hi. We got a puzzling question. We got a log cabin that's been up about 14 years, and one of the posts, we noticed a little fine sawdust right below the post, and we found a hole coming out, and a little worm about 3/4 of an inch long, 7/8 maybe, back end of it about 8-inch diameter, but a bulbing head, which looks like a couple eyes trying to pop out.
Sure. Yeah, no, the eyes honestly are jaws. So it is, we have a number of families of wood-boring beetles. Two of the bigger ones, as far as size and numbers, are the longhorn wood borers and the metallic wood borers. So it's one of those, without seeing it, I'm thinking more it is probably a metallic wood borer. And normally, you expect them to emerge within 2 to 3 years at most of when the wood was cut. But there are examples of individuals that will go for an extended time. I had a sample out of Door County where the framing that was put up was over 30 years old before the critter came out.
Wow.
But the good news about these critters is they can't get back in. So they cause the cosmetic injury. And what we think is going on is the less nutritional quality of the wood, the longer it takes them to develop. So this means things weren't going very well for that critter, but it's finally got to the time it was thinking that what they'll often do is feed out to the surface, prepare the hole to emerge, transform into the adult beetle. That takes usually a few weeks, and then the adult comes popping out. So I think that's what you saw. So I said, if you look under longhorn wood borer or metallic wood borer, and we call them round-headed borers or flat-headed borers are the terms that are often given commonly to them on the internet. See if that matches up. But I'm not concerned about any structural problems. As I said, you just had one of these curious cases that took the insect a heck of a lot longer to come out than what we would consider normal.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Jake, for calling. And Don in Warren, Illinois. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a suggestion. About 30 years ago, my wife planted some comfrey. I didn't know why. I don't know where it came from. I don't have a use for it. But recently we have noticed that bumblebees are on it all day long, from daylight till dark, all summer long. It's about a perennial that grows, soft tissue, so it dies back. But it keeps producing dark blue flowers all summer long, and the bumblebees are just in it all the time. Well, then recently we found out that bumblebees do the best job at pollinating tomatoes, and they have to vibrate them in, I think, in the C note to make the pollen come loose. Well, we just have tons of tomatoes, so I said, aha! Now we know the combination, that we have a good host plant for the bumblebees. And so I look in the seed catalogs, and I had a hard time finding any reference to comfrey, even in my flower books. I don't know where you're going to find it, but boy, if you can, that is the physarinctum for the pollinators, and there are half a dozen to a dozen bumblebees on it all summer long.
That's pretty cool, Phil.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And this one of the things that's happened, and this started with, I think, the concerns of what's happening with honeybees, is there's been a whole lot of interest in studying native pollinators. And, you know, we have over 400 species of native bees in Wisconsin, and many of them have very specific requirements. And even the bumblebees, we're upwards of, I think, about 12 species of bumblebees in the state, and some bumblebees are having problems, some not. But, again, finding this kind of combination of you got to do some homework on these things. But if you provide the right combinations, you end up getting the benefit. And this sounds like a perfect combination for especially tomatoes, as you say, because they're much more dependent on bumblebees than other bees for pollination.
Talking about the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Phil, quickly, how deep do you make those 3/8-inch holes for mason bees?
I would like to see a minimum of 3 to 4 inches.
Okay.
You can make them a little bit more, much more than that probably is not needed, but I would shoot for that 3 to maybe 6 inches max.
Phil is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, and we have lots of open lines. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I had a couple of great photos here on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly, if you have a question or photo, you can post it there. And we'll be back with Phil right after this look at the news. No matter what the season, there are countless insects around us. And whether you're talking about mosquitoes or moths or box elder bugs or millipedes, always a fascinating and informative conversation when Phil Pelletieri joins us, our UW entomologist, guide to the world of insects. It's great to have him back. He's a distinguished faculty associate, emeritus professor.
Sure.
I like that.
I've been called worse.
Yeah. And it's always a pleasure, Phil. Thanks for coming
by.
Nice
to be here.
We have open lines. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org and post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly if you've got, we have some nice insect photos, you could add a photo to that as well, and maybe, well, not maybe, Phil will identify it for you. Paul in Powers, Wisconsin has a question. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Last fall, I collected a cocoon, and had a lot of fun with my granddaughter listening to it move the pupae inside moving around, and so winter was coming on, so I took it and put it in the freezer to let it know that winter was here. And about a month ago, we took it out of the freezer, and a couple days went by, and we could hear the movement inside of it. And then a couple days later, it hatched out. We had either a Polyphemus or a Cercopia moth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know which one it was, but the moth flew around the kitchen for a few days. We couldn't find it. And then one day we found it, and we put it into a plastic container. And then it commenced to start laying eggs. At least I think they were eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was wondering if those eggs are viable.
Yeah, the problem is she didn't fertilize. So they'll lay their eggs as kind of a last gasp type thing,
yeah.
But if they're not fertilized, no, they won't be.
Okay. Yep. Well, it was a lot of fun. That little girl just was so fascinated with that moth flying around in the kitchen here. And, yeah, I gave up the ghost a few days later.
Yeah, well, they are very short-lived in nature. They have the biggest problem staying away from the bats because they make great bat food, so they often don't last more than a couple of days. And yeah, you did everything right. The only thing that normally would help, I would think, is be take it out of the freezer later and get it on kind of more of a natural schedule. Because one of the things you'll find is if you've got a screen porch or something similar and you have a female like that and she emerges, let's say, in May or early June, if you leave her in the porch, She will send out a chemical, a pheromone, to attract males. And so you wake up the next morning and there's three males sitting on the screen that haven't been able to get to her. Once she's made it, she stops doing this. We call it calling behavior. So sometimes you can attract a number of males into an area if you've got a virgin female like that. But it's got to be the right season. And then again, it's a bit too early for that.
Yeah, there you go, Paul. Thanks for calling. Oh, Jim in Madison. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I got a bunch of little teeny, teeny ants. You can't hardly see them in the house. We put out some traps for about 3 weeks, and didn't seem to have any effect. And then they just sprayed the one corner where they seemed to be coming in. They're still coming. They're dying, but they're coming, and we found them in other places in the house. What do you suggest?
Okay, so... the problem with baits is you got to make sure the bait has got the kind of food complement they want. And so what we've talked about before on the show is most ants either have a sweet tooth, so they like things that are sugar-based, or other ants have a protein fat base. So sometimes just doing something as simple as a piece of wax paper and put a little bit of honey or, you know, some corn syrup, something sweet versus more of a cooking oil and see which they want. And that will direct you which kind of baits to use. Now... if I had to guess, and it is a guess, I'm wondering if they're pavement ants. And what makes pavement ants somewhat challenging is it's not one nest. It's usually multiple nests. And so you keep baiting and keep baiting. But as they said, it's all about matching up the bait. And the best baits you would have to go on the internet to buy, but there are some pretty reasonable commercial baits. And the thing about spraying is if you spray the nest, you get them. But if you don't spray the nest, all you're doing is killing sterile female workers. You're not killing the queen, so the nest still sustains itself. So I think baiting is a better technology, but it sometimes takes even months, to be honest, if you've got multiple nests, to get enough bait available. And what the concept is the baits are slow acting. They feed them to each other, and that's how you wipe the colony out.
I've seen some. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I would say, so you put a drop of sugary something in, and what'd you say, oil?
Yeah, some kind of oil base, and see which of the two they have a preference. And some ants will feed on both. And then you try to match the bait. So when you buy the bait, is it for sweet-feeding ants? Is it for protein-feeding ants? Some will be called dual-choice baits. If we get real technical, as I said, then what I'd say is send some ants in, and the diagnostician on campus here will identify them, and then... yeah, you said you can go to there are a number of specialized internet sites called Do Your Own Pest Control and various versions of that that sell the commercially baits that are out there. And, you know, certain baits are made for certain ants is what it comes to. And these are often specialized products, so you don't find them at the hardware store. But yeah. As I said, I'm not sure you can go there. People do have good luck with the combat baits, but the biggest mistake I see them make sometimes, as I said, they buy the wrong kind of bait and the ants show no interest because it doesn't have the right food source for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the oil doesn't have to be WT.
No, not petroleum based. It's got to be a vegetable oil.
It got to be a vegetable oil. And as you say, you can get these little houses that have both types.
Yeah, right. And you know, so they're mixing peanut butter, sometimes ground up silkworm, sometimes honey. Again, as much like we talked about the cockroaches earlier in the show, that the toxicants they're using, sometimes it's boric acid. Sometimes it's insect growth hormones, some very interesting products in these things. And the nice thing about these baits is you've got total control of them. They're not available to pets. Generally, some of these are almost, we call them hockey pucks in the business sometimes because they're little tin containers that, as I said, are pretty much tamper-proof. But yet they've got little openings for the ants to get. Try to put the baits as close to where you're seeing the activity, and do not mix sprays with baits because the sprays are often repellent.
Yeah.
So you're going the wrong direction with it. You can put it in different areas. That's okay. But not spray an area and then put a bait on top of it. That's not going to work.
And I should mention that Judith wrote an article for WPR.org about what you had to say the last time you were on about feeding and knowing food preferences of ants and so forth, and we'll, she's going to repost that up on Facebook. She's already done that, reposted it on Facebook. So if you want some more information, take a look at that article on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. Gene and Milton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I've got an ash tree that I'm going to treat again this year. I talked to a couple of folks in Janesville area here, It's about 20-inch diameter, and it was suggested that I go to a professional injecting a product rather than treating on the ground as I had in the past. What's the best way to approach that and the best timing and best chemicals to use?
Okay. So, I mean, there's a couple different strategies, but the bottom line is the bigger the tree it is, the harder it is to treat. Now, one of the problems with some of the over-the-counter products is that the labels do not allow you to use enough product to make it effective. And you know, the professionals often have different formulations. They can play around with this a little bit easier. One of the other things it's done, though, is a trick, is the product will allow you to apply it in the fall and then reapply it in the spring. That is not considered two treatments in one calendar year. You cannot put it in the same fall or spring of the same year. That's not technically legal. But one of the ways of staying within the letter of the law but yet getting higher dosage is do a fall application and a spring application on these bigger trees. Now, with injectables, it's a quicker method. There's even some injectables like the Triage product that will last a number of years. They will claim up to 3 years with the treatment. So there's a lot of factors that you kind of go into. And as I said, bigger trees, if you don't want to have to play this game of when you can apply and the like, it probably is. If it's a high-value tree, then get a professional arborist to come in. All the products work well. They really do. That's the one thing about the systemics with this. If you get them on and you get them in the right dosages, again, you can expect to get good results as far as control. And, you know, you're in one of the hot areas. And unfortunately, now we got a lot of hot areas in the state. I think we're up to 19 counties now that are quarantined with EAB. You will see in areas, you know, often from the time it's first found in the county until people start seeing dying trees might be 3 or 4 years. But it starts to gain momentum. And so, again, I think being proactive in a place like Milton is a good idea if you got a high-value tree.
I see our I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just the timing on that, I was told starting probably any time now for the next 2 to 3 weeks would be the appropriate timing.
Yeah, the timing isn't as critical other than the argument is, of course, can't be frozen soil. You don't want things to be too flooded because that will affect putting systemics on. And the tree's very busy uptaking things right now. So generally, that's why they shoot for the spring application in particular.
I saw that in the Wisconsin State Journal this morning that our Mayor Soglin in Madison is going to be spending quite a bit of money or asking for a few $100,000 for control. Are you going to see more of that in the communities?
Well, I think most city foresters are working with this, are taking the approach, let's identify high-value trees that, you know, that aesthetically are good and whatnot, and let's put up the fight. It's worth putting up the fight. Those are very valuable aesthetically and even, you know, real estate-wise for doing it. And the other side of it is there are a number of trees that are structurally not right or under power lines or whatnot. They're never going to be a nice tree. So it's better for those cases to remove those trees. So it's kind of a combination rather than, you know, some people have decided let's cut all the ash trees down. Personally, I can't buy into that. There's some lovely trees I think that are well worth saving. And I think that's where we're sitting in Madison, as I said, identifying some of these high value trees and putting up the fight.
We have some great photos on Facebook. One is from Linda here 2 years ago today. She saw this. I had 5 of those in her garden. They look like tobacco hornworms.
It's in the hornworm family, but the color patterns, this is the white-lined sphinx moth, which we had so many adults last year. And they're quite variable. You can get one form that's totally black with yellow lines. You can get this one. The amount of black and red spotting can differ, so you got to be careful when you're trying to identify these things because, as I said, one critter can have 5 different forms of caterpillars. But that's definitely a white line. They like purslane. Once in a while, they'll chew on a garden plant. Evening primrose is one thing they'll pick on once in a while. But generally speaking, you know, hornworms aren't that destructive, and the adult hawk moths are just neat critters. And they burrow in the ground, pupate in the ground. That's how they spend the winter, and then we'll get the adults emerging.
Here's another one. Katie sent this photo. She's wondering, it was in her van last October, wondering what it was.
Okay, so I'm making a little bit of a guess here. When you look at the critter, it gives you kind of this grasshoppery type effect.
Yeah.
But what I think it is a true bug. And so instead of a chewing mouth part, it has a sucking mouth part. And you can't quite see that, but just the general form. This is an immature, we would call a nymph. But it looks to me to be some type of an assassin bug. You know, predators, kind of neat critters. You got to be a little careful with assassin bugs because if mishandled and they take offense, they'll bite.
Yeah.
But other than that, they're predators on insects. And so you can argue they're a part of the natural control that's going on out there.
Interesting nail polish, too.
Yes.
You got there, Katie. Let's take a look here. Whoa, yeah.
Now we got a white line here. Yeah. So this is the adult of that caterpillar that we saw. And as I said, it was a treat last year because the late summer we had more white line sphinx out there than I have seen. I think only one other time in my career I've seen these kind of numbers. So often in August you could see four or five of them in your garden in the late afternoon. And my gut feeling it'll be a while before we get that kind of blessing again.
Carolyn in Wautoma, thank you for calling. Hi.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a little embarrassed about telling you this, but I've got this strange little cocoon-type quarter-inch long, very narrow, but there's a white grubby type of a little worm thing in there. It's got a little black head, and it doesn't come out that I can see. They seem to be along the where the carpeting and the baseboard meet. And it's kind of grayish and darker gray in color as far as the cocoon is concerned. The worm itself is white and then it has this darker head. If you kind of pinch one side, it'll try to crawl out the other side, but never really comes all the way out.
Okay, so my first question is this wool carpeting?
It's Berber. I don't know.
Okay. Unfortunately, there's a number of species. The two that come to mind that I would expect to make cocoons indoors, one's associated with bird seed and dry goods and the like. It's the Indian meal moth. And I think typically when people have problems with that beast, you see the little moths flying around all the time, you know, over time. And without you saying that. So then it takes me back to there is a case-making clothes moth. Where the caterpillar makes a little case, it has a little black head. Now, clothes moths have to feed on natural hair. So we find them in silk, we find them in, you know, deer mounts and, you know, pelts, that kind of thing, but they also feed on wool.
How about cat fur? We have two kitties.
Yes. Uh-huh. If there was enough accumulated cat fur, I have seen clothes moths feeding on that. And the biggest concern there, so if it's synthetic carpet, you don't worry, but if you've got valuable woolens in the house, you know, you don't want clothes moths starting a population because then again, it will be a threat to your sweaters and you know, fine wool, coats and that kind of stuff. So, you know, in doubt, get a couple of them, mail them off to the local extension office. If they can't handle it, they'll send it to the diagnostic lab and we'll get a proper identification. But yeah, if this persists, I think it's worth following through on this because, as I said, if it is case-making clothes moth, then I think it's got to be dealt with.
Is there anything, what can I do other than just suck them up with a vacuum cleaner?
Oh, no, that's a good idea at first. Let's see what I hate to see you spraying things when we're not sure what it is.
Especially when I have kitties.
I
try to use the most organic way I possibly can with anything.
Yeah, well, there are some organic products that could be considered, but let's make sure what you got. I mean, it's a little unusual. Usually when I see clothes moths associated with animal fur, it's fur that is accumulated in air ducts and other places that are out of the way, you know, rather than just a little bit of miscellaneous hair that animals shed, you know, in a living room. But as I said, I think it's worth following through on it.
Thanks for calling, Carolyn. Mary sent us a nice photo on my Facebook page, too. What is that beauty?
Okay, so it's a longhorn wood boring beetle, or what we call cerambycids. And off the top of my head, it doesn't look like... I mean, it's such a big family. I can't give you an exact name of it, but it's definitely out of that group. Tetrapoides sticks in my mind as the potential genus, but I'm taking a wild guess at that one. But a longhorn wood bore... almost exclusively, the larvae are associated with dead and dying trees. The adults do feed on pollen, so sometimes you'll see them on goldenrod is a good place to collect them. Like I said, I think if you get into a place like Bug Guide and have the patience to go through their thousands of pictures, you can get an identification, and it will be identified by that pattern on the back because they're all very distinctive.
And Diane sent us a really cool photo of
Bumblebee convention.
Yeah, on her sunflower. My yes. goodness.
Yes. You know, it's kind of fun. And as I said, the neat thing, if you're interested in getting into bumblebees now, is there's a number of guides to help you identify the various species. And it depends on the amount of yellow striping. Some even have orange striping on the bodies. And, you know, as I said, like other things in nature, the more you understand the diversity there, the more interesting they are. And so you might be able to get some more stuff, as I said, on these bumblebee identification guides that I'm seeing showing up in a number of places.
Trevor would like to get rid of his garden of squash vine borers. The past couple of years have decimated his zucchini and summer squash. I mean, you got to clean the garden.
The problem with squash vine borer is the adult moth is mobile enough that you could magically get rid of everything in your yard, and it does not guarantee that they're not coming again. So critical time is the last week of June, first week of July. There are some organic products, in particular the spinosad products are very effective, is used as a foliar treatment when the moths are laying their eggs. And so you got about a 2 or 3 week window that you've got to protect them. Once they hatch and the larvae go inside the plant, we've lost the war. So, and then later on is when the plant wilts. So often people are late in coming to it. So as I said, if I had to give you advice, if you're using conventional insecticides, Carbaryl or 7 would be effective. If you want organic, the spinosad product would work. But the critical time is that last few days of June and that first 10 days of July, as far as I'm concerned.
And Pat in Cottage Grove, do you have a quick question?
Yes. I heard a talk by the Xerxes Society about the declining numbers of ground nesting bees and how important it was to keep holes in the ground and holes in hollow logs so that they would have a place to nest. And of course, for people who want to get rid of yellow jackets, you talked about plugging up all the holes that you've got. So how do you reconcile those two viewpoints?
It's the size of the hole. Yellow jackets are using big holes, the size of baseballs. They're using gopher burrows. They're not using these half-inch, three-eighths-inch wood borer holes that the bees are using. The same thing with the ground-nesting solitary bees. You don't have to dig holes for them. They dig their own holes. What they need is bare soil, you know, piles of soil to dig into. So people see these first spring bees that come out when the crocuses come out. Very docile bees, nothing to worry about there. They're not making these giant nests that will get worse. They're only active for a couple weeks. So, yeah, it's all about providing the right habitat. But as I said, the big thing is when I'm talking about a yellow jacket nest, it's a very different thing. It's usually a very large opening that everybody, there's a paper wasp nest in the ground is what there is.
Yeah.
Is that what we're seeing? And so, as I said, those are the ones that I would want to plug up. So there was an old gopher burrow chipmunk hole, and those are not the kind that these pollinating bees would use.
And Eric in Endeavor, just because we're getting close to time, had a PVC tube in his yard with a hive in it. Any worries about that now anymore?
Same thing. They're dead. You can clean it out depending what its use was. It was using for a water line or whatnot. That would be fine. And the big question is where they would get some access. Although, you know, again, a lot of these things are looking for shelter. And in particular, this European paper wasp that's come in the state the last 4 or 5 years is notorious for making these little nests underneath things and behind things.
There you go. Phil, you're coming back next month or so. Yes, good. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. He will be back again to talk with us about the world of insects in about a month, as a matter of fact. Just to take a look ahead at what's coming up tomorrow, a really pretty book out. It's 10,000 Birds, Ornithology Since Darwin. So kind of a history of birds and birding since Charles Darwin. So that's at 11. And then at a little bit later on, we're going to be talking about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, that probably at around noon, we'll visit about that. And that Birdathon coming up in just a few weeks. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.